Good afternoon. My name is Sei Kim. I'm currently at the American Association for the Advancement of Science, Dialogue on Science, Ethics, and Religion. Yes, it's a really long name. That's why we have acronyms. But thank you for joining us here today. We have a panel, a wonderful panel of speakers. I won't take too much of your time except to say that I know our session is science literacy, and as a moderator, I would like to say that I think there's a component, a rich component in literacy that should be engagement, and I think all our speakers really reflect that, so I hope you enjoy the session. If we can ask our speakers to project, because I know there are no microphones, again, so just as a reminder. First up, we have Jack Swearingen, and he's going to talk about science literacy for the church.
There's some really tough competition to this session, some high-class competition, so I think I bribed all of you. Thank you. I bribed as many as I could. Thank you for coming. I'm an elder in my church, First Presbyterian Church of Santa Rosa, California, and I'm responsible for... Oh, this is as loud as I can yell. And my functional oversight area is discipleship, mostly adult discipleship, but millennials are sort of on the edge of that, and we have been concerned about the decline of, or the scarcity of, millennials and young adults from the church, and that's not unique to us, it's true nationwide. And as an ASA elder, as an ASA fellow, I began to wonder how much of that is due to the conflict between science and faith. And so I began to investigate that from that standpoint, and I'll share my findings with you and my interpretation thereof. This already, let's see how to go backward. This issue of National Geographic was published in March 2014, and it's just talks about skepticism of science in the West, especially the U.S. And there's a number of particular things that were featured there, like climate change, evolution, the moon landing, vaccinations, GMO foods. Those were the features of that special issue. And I threw in a few others just out of my own observation base. Fluoride is a new neurotoxin. We shouldn't put it in public drinking water. Cell phones and transmission lines cause cancer. Industrial farming is not sustainable. Gluten causes a myriad of illnesses. Pesticides in non-organic foods make us all sick, et cetera, et cetera. So there's plenty of those things out there. And just for interest, it's not just in the U.S. In this fall, education season, Turkey will stop teaching evolution in the grade schools and high schools because it's not—it's too Eurocentric. Now, that's the theory. Now, the guy on the left is the president of Turkey, and the fellow on the right is Charles Darwin. So we've made an opposition in Turkey. It's not limited to the technological West. This book by Endo Stillman I will refer to more than once, but he points out a fundamental disconnect between the cognitive state of individuals and the cognitive demands of industrial society. There's a struggle that's part of the problem, or part of the cause of the problem. As an aside, and underlining his point, historically he says, reclassification of emergent phenomena from things to processes was a critical first step in establishing several domains of science. But such reclassification rarely permeates popular consciousness because the cognitive demands of systems-based thinking are too high. In other words, he's saying, come to terms with technological society is too demanding for most people to deal with, so they resort to intuitive theories, which I'll get back to. All this brings you to the question, does it matter? can our society function just fine or our churches just fine without solving this problem? And I think, yes, it is a problem. It does matter. And I threw up my own thoughts as to what some of those consequences might be. If, in fact, science is turning people away from the church or the supposed conflict, we've got a problem. If the church members can't discern truth from falsehood, in other words, alternative facts, we've got a problem. If they're engaging in environmentally damaging practices because they haven't been taught that environmental protection is, in fact, a biblical mandate, therefore, they might even not be participating in God's program of healing, which is about now. If we're not vaccinating our children, we've got a problem of destroying herd immunity. We're electing politicians who are anti-science. We support public policies that are not based upon science. We discourage our children, or this is discouraging children from studying, taking in STEM as a field. And maybe, I submit, in many cases, we wind up working against God's purposes. Now, what is it in Scripture that we can say about this? Does it matter? In Philippians 2:5, Paul writes, "In your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ." Remember the word mindset. In Philippians 3:15, Paul tells us to follow his example, those of us who are mature, and at some point you think differently, that too God will make clear to you. So the word think, I want you to ponder. In Philippians 4:8, Paul writes, "Finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, noble, right, pure, lovely, admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about these things." And one more, in Romans 12:2, "Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And then you'll be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will." So you put those together, Paul is teaching us that thoughts and attitudes are the basis of speech and action, the basis of right speech and action. This needs to be understood in an age in which there is a great emphasis on feelings and experience. So we're talking cognitive, we're talking right thinking that precedes or perhaps is required for right action. David Kinnaman wrote several years ago in his book, "Churches Seem Overprotected." This is what young adults are saying. Churches are overprotective. Their experience of Christianity is shallow. The church has come across as antagonistic to science. Christians know all the answers, don't need science. Church experiences related to sexuality are often simplistic. The exclusive nature of Christianity is also cited as a reason for leaving the church. And then for doubters, the church seems unfriendly. There's the project, which many of you are already familiar with, out of Fuller, Science and Theology for Emerging Adult Ministries. I haven't seen any reports coming out yet, but I like their mission statement. And their mission statement is they're dealing with the obstacle that Christianity is in conflict with science and vice versa, that there's a disconnect of this whole topic from pressing life issues. It's maybe not important. And the perception the Bible is undated and unscientific when it comes to science. And finally, 18 to 30-year-olds face dizzying array of choices, which make it difficult to decide just what to do about this issue. Walt Hearn, who died just a few months ago, was one of the original founding members of ASA, and at his memorial service, this quote from him was repeated. ASA was formed to tell the church about science and scientists about the Christian faith. You can find something close to that in today's statement of ASA. It's in the little handout from the annual report. Now, BioLogos and Institute for Creation Research have similar mission statements, but they focus on the origins debate. ASA is much broader than that. Reasons to Believe has a similar mission, but they have a model for cosmic history, which they're focusing on. Several other Christian ministries, I found a couple more yesterday at the poster session or the book table. Several other ministries would identify with a mission just about like this. But as I said already, I think ASA is uniquely positioned to address the many broad aspects of the encounter between science and faith. And that's what I'll try to proceed to convince you. Rush Holt, Chief Executive Officer of AAAS, wrote this in the May 5th issue of Science Magazine. There is a cause for concern. He says evidence seems optional in public debates and policymaking. That is evidence, hard evidence. Federal funding for R&D is less than half of what it was in the 60s. I just read again today that ARPA-E, the energy aspect part of DOE, is once again being zeroed out by the House. Back and forth it goes. And free pursuit of scientific questions is hampered by political restrictions on travel or access to information. So AAAS, session chair is AAAS, is concerned. In Earth Day this year, we had the March on Science in much of the Western world. And I got a couple of shots from the web. You can look at some of their signs. Some of them are for environmental causes, but there's a lot for science as well. Evidence-based medicine, that was her thing. And I took this picture in Berkeley, outside a bookstore in Berkeley, the day after. In fact, we were there for Walt Hearn's funeral, I think, or memorial service. Why science matters, why science is under assault, that's why we're marching. And here's a tattoo of the combined first and second laws of thermo, which relates to previous talks in this very room. In other words, he's saying, yay thermo. So, why do people say that they reject scientific authority? The tribe determines what I think. And if the claims are conflicting, who do I believe? The previous talk in this room tried to examine the reasons for making choices in this area. And I think the young Earth creationist attacks on science are a problem for us. Confirmation bias, people want to hear and want to read what they want to read that confirms their own beliefs. Media is under distress, especially when it reports on science. Science is biased by funding sources, or so it is believed, and to some extent must be true. And authority figures, if they say science is wrong, we tend to be swayed by that. Net present value, people put off, postpone concerns in the future with impacts that are very contemporary. So they discount the impact in the future. Moral reasoning are private, moral reasoning errors are public and consequential, whereas scientific reasoning errors are private and less consequential. Dominion theology is a problem. You've heard it from other talks. And Platonism, you've heard this too. Jesus wouldn't let me be damaged by any of this. I don't have to worry about it. Industry-sponsored research, of course, examples would be the great tobacco industry campaign against the problems of smoking. Pharmaceutical claims that they're paying for pharmaceutical research to sell pills. The fossil fuel industry today, chemical industry wants to sell chemicals, fertilizers, and pesticides. The whole food industry wants you to buy their product and discount the ingredients thereof. So what do we do? What do we do with all this? Well, scientific fact is not just based upon comprehension. Alan Lesher writes, scientific facts can be compromised whenever the information confronts people's personal views or worldviews, or when the facts provoke fear or fear of loss of control. And he says that, okay, if these are true, the only way forward is to have reasonable, genuine, respectful dialogues. And that's where I'm going to wrap up. But before that, we need to recognize that skepticism of science is associated with concepts that are rather intangible. How many non-scientific people understand the science of mathematics of complex systems, or the idea that the world is full of dynamic systems? They're not static, they're not packages that we assimilate and master and that's the end of learning. They're ongoing processes. They're not things anymore. And emergent outcomes, it wasn't until I got into graduate school and out that I recognized that the whole is usually greater than the sum of its parts, and there's surprises that emerge from putting things together. Now, the Pew Research Society has published a number of investigations, conducted and published a number of investigations into what causes people to be, shapes their attitudes about science and other issues. Here's 22 different science issues, and I won't expect you to read them all. And they then did a multivariate statistical analysis of all these to try to determine what the key deciding factors were. Of course, you know, they can't boil it down to one or two, but they did conclude that political views are strongly linked to attitudes about climate and energy, and that politics is less important on other issues other than those two. There's another Pew research study. I just copied this out of a report. This looks at church attendance on things like evolution, animal research, and genetic modification, and a bunch of other issues. And very briefly, resistance factors are central only to a handful of these issues. Foremost is the evolution creation debate. That's one of the key. Religious group differences are particularly strong in terms of determining how people perceive whether or not they think there's a scientific consensus about one topic or another. Political attitudes and educational level are important, but religion is very important. Now, here's where I'm getting into editorial commentary. In my mind, these surveys identify so many variables that you can't come up with a clear and straightforward cause and effect issue. In fact, there's lots of inconsistencies in people's positions and trying to extract cause and effect. Like people say, I accept biological evolution as scientific, but AGW is not scientific, therefore I reject that one. But there's probably hidden variables going on here. Not probably, there are. So I'm going to offer a simple framework for understanding that's on a different level from what I would call a sociological research project. And it's the idea of open and closed. And if I can say, if science is open and closed and religion is open, there's not going to be, there's maybe some communication, but not a whole lot. If both science and religion are closed, no possibility of dialogue. If science and religion are both open, there could be the opportunity for dialogue if both demonstrate sufficient humility to proceed. And then perhaps dialogue will be possible, but not guaranteed. So what makes a person closed? Oh, I'm sorry. Put yourself on these axes if possible. Where do you think ASA is? Or ICR, Biologos, Reasons to Believe, Discovery Institute, God's Two Books, Natural Theology, and Blind Wandsbaker. They're all in different quadrants, in my view. And you can look at yourself, too. Where would you place yourself? How far out in one of those quadrants? And what makes a person closed versus open in their thinking? And I'll just list these. But the mindset is where Stuhlman comes in, and I'll close at this point. Intuitive worldview theories are ones that we kind of form before we're educated. They relate to our tribe and to our family context and our own childhood experiences. And we construct these, but to change them to scientific-based views or cognitive views is not easy. It requires conceptual change, and that's hard. And so it's in fact, when people come up with tough situations, they often revert to their intuitive views without even realizing it. The intuitive views are always there lurking under the surface. But in Andrew Stillman's view, the scientific training can overcome these for a time, but beware, the others are always lurking. And so I'm saying that if we're aware that the intuitive views are formed by every one of us, scientific training can change our worldviews, but they don't actually obliterate the intuitive views that we form as young people. And if, in fact, we never have any cognitive training, intuitive views are what drive our entire being. So I'm now done. Let me conclude. Successful participation in technological society requires basic proficiencies in STEM. That means you have to know how to use an adding machine, how to read ingredients on a label. You have to have a running total in your mind at the store that you don't exceed your available cash, just as much as cooking, cleaning, grooming, and mending. Secondly, science need to gain an understanding of some of the reasons that underlie science skepticism that will help with this conversation. Thirdly, we need to construct new narratives that communicate outside this tribe, the science tribe. And fourthly, we can do science lectures, and perhaps many people in this room have done them and do them. Even showing the heavens may not persuade the skeptics. We need to understand intuitive theories, how about their presence and their working and lurking in people, but we have to proceed with humility. And finally, I submit that because of its breadth, ASA is uniquely positioned, especially equipped to bring science literacy to the church in all its breadth. And I'm done. Thank you. I put some bibliographies on the back table if anybody cares to look at the sources that I used.
We have some time for questions, but so I would like to start say something where we have a tradition at AAAS. A question is something that ends with an inflection up. So, questions?
I'm a question, Jack.
I'm not surprised.
I really agree with most of what you said, but I'm not sure how to apply that. I'm thinking of whether it's either a politician to vote for or a church to go to. The people's perspective on science is important, but that's not the only issue I care about. Or how do I decide at what point is their science so bad I don't want to go to that church or vote for that person? Or what do I overlook the science because they're so bad?
So I added confusion to your life, not I reduced it. You'll obviously have to take this and decide how valuable this is for you in your worldview, but I'm adding awareness of intuitive theories and how if people operate solely by them, we are probably going to wind up opposing God's plan one way or another. And a short circuit to wind up in that position is to operate on entirely intuitive theories. How's that? Will that work? Okay, back here.
The fun slide that you put up said that people need a basic science proficiency. I find that people's science proficiency can be divided into sort of two sets. One is knowing the current results that science has come up with, and the other is understanding the process by which science works. Can you give any comment on how those two aspects of science proficiency interact?
I don't think you have to be a scientist, but I think we need to be explaining the scientific process and its way of acquiring knowledge. I heard it said earlier in the conference that you can't just go out and walk around nature and come fully to God's revealed plan, nor do you understand scientific processes. So, let's see if I can summarize that. I think that when we communicate, we need to try to explain as simply as possible what the scientific process is and how it differs from non-scientific processes. That'll have to do for the moment. Back.
Have you, in your reading and your own thinking, I'm thinking particularly about school situations, but church as well. Have you run into anything that deals with whether it's easier for people to get a useful knowledge of scientific process through dealing with hot button issues that they care about a lot, maybe, but that are very hard to change your perspective on, versus things where you can illustrate it very simply, like the pH of this solution versus that, but people don't have a lot of investment in it. I'm struggling with this idea of dealing with high investment, high rigidity yeah. issues versus low investment, low rigidity.
I think it's wise, based on my own experience and preference too, that we don't want to try to teach science, but just some precepts and principles, and using non-controversial topics to introduce the way scientists think and learn is probably a good way to begin.
Stay tuned for my talk.
Okay. So we put this up here in anticipation of your. I saw one more hand. Michael?
Jack, do you think that, you know, the last 10, 15 years, our lives have become increasingly dominated by the internet? Do you think that that has helped or hurt? And I ask because it seems to me the internet allows for the preponderance of, I would say, alternative facts that are disguised to look like real. Do you think that's had a net effect one way or the
well,
other?
Well, hey, this was not a report of a laboratory study that I did. I did most of the research on the internet. So clearly, it's a boost. But I have to use my own cognitive skills, such as they are, to discern truth from alt truth that I get from the internet. I get bombarded with spam, as you probably do too. Just click here, and oh, by the way, I'm in prison, and I'm one of your relatives, and furthermore, I'm in Africa, and if you'll send money, I want to put money in your account, if you'll just, you know, those are obvious, but there are a lot that are much more clever than that, and not so obvious. So it's everything. It's all those things. It's not going to be simple, I'm afraid. At least it hasn't been for me. One, I guess, one more.
Yeah, have you run into a conflicts in the church when you're trying to present this?
Yes.
And so what do you do?
Yes.
What do you have you run into the anti-science?
In my church, somebody said earlier in the conference that I'm a duck out of water in the church and a duck out of water here, not here, in science. Because as a Christian in science, I'm a minority, and science in the church, I'm a minority. And so I say, well, how can I possibly make the church more scientifically literate? I've been part of a group that's given seminars, and we've shown the cosmos, and we've shown the history of the science and religion debate, and we've talked about modern ethical issues in science. And people are very intrigued, but they'll say, I still don't think global warming is happening. And I have to say, well, why is that? Well, because it's a socialist plot or something. So then you get into their worldviews and you can start a dialogue. My default reaction is to be annoyed and want to fight. And that doesn't work. I have to fight my own nature to say, now, let's talk about how you came to that view and how you go about making decisions and so forth. That's my offering.
Can we thank Jack?